You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Rae Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Back in 2020, in the wake of the pandemic, Australian universities were confronting the loss of foreign students, the mass layoff of academics, legal issues due to the underpayment of staff, and a radical change in domestic university fees. 5 years later, things have not got any better. And arguably worse.
Now, we've been looking at the state of Australian higher education over the past couple of months, a sector which feels like it's in crisis.
The University of Technology Sydney has confirmed it will push ahead with plans to axe almost a third of its subjects and more than 160 jobs.
Battle lines are being drawn on university campuses, with thousands of staff being sacked and courses cut in the biggest shakeup since the pandemic. Unions are blaming corporate managers, accusing them of cutting deeper than they need to, while university leaders say they're doing their best with a perfect storm of challenges.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. So why are our universities in so much trouble? And when did things start to go wrong? Like so many stories, there's a short answer and a long answer. And as always, it's the long answer that interests us. Australia's first universities were established in the 1800s and were originally focused on vocational training. Glyn Davis is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Crawford School at the Australian National University and the author of The Australian Idea of a University.
We started discussing the possibility of a university as early as the 1820s. The key advocate was William Charles Wentworth. He argued it on very pragmatic grounds. We were going to need lawyers and doctors and engineers, and we needed to train them in Australia because it just wasn't practical for young men like him, and he was only thinking of young men, to go back to England, in a sense, to train. Not surprisingly, they looked to Britain for inspiration. And by Britain, they didn't mean, as you might expect, Oxford and Cambridge. They much more meant Glasgow, Edinburgh, Dublin, the new universities in London. They didn't see the ancient universities as the right model for Australia. They were much more interested in institutions that were training for the professions.
The first university in Australia is the University of Sydney. It's established in 1850.
James Waghorn, Senior Research Fellow at the Melbourne Centre for Higher Education, University of Melbourne.
And it's followed a few years later by my university, the University of Melbourne, in 1853. These are public institutions, and they see their mission very much as providing a civilizing influence on the young colonies in Australia. But they move very swiftly. At the University of Melbourne, in its second year, moves into professional training as well.
And those universities up until sort of Federation, how were they paid for?
So the establishment costs came from the colonial governments. There were grants in the New South Wales Parliament and then the Victorian Parliament and so on. Students, by and large, paid their own fees, which ensured that they came from prosperous families. They were, of course, in the first decades, exclusively male. And there were scholarships, and that was a small part at first and a growing part. When the Commonwealth became more involved in the 20th century in universities, that scholarships mechanism was a very important part of expanding out who went to university. So we always had a significant private component. Although we often talk about the relatively few years in which universities were free, for most of Australian history, students paid a significant part of their education, either directly up front or they were supported by a scholarship that put them through.
So what percentage of the population, say, at the time of Federation would actually be going to university?
Quite a low percentage. At the time of Federation in 1901, there are only four institutions in total across Australia. There's Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide and the University of Tasmania. And there are fewer than a couple of thousand students, really, nationally.
And I'm imagining that they were primarily middle-class people, middle and upper-class people?
Definitely middle-class people. There's also opportunity for some number of other students who are able to obtain various scholarships.
And what involvement did the Commonwealth have in university education before World War II?
The Commonwealth has a very limited involvement in funding Australian universities. They're all incorporated under state acts of legislation still today, and they are funded by state governments up until the Second World War, really, when the federal government contributes some money towards their operation. But we see the introduction of dedicated research funding at the beginning of the 20th century. So universities are here also to support Australia's key industries.
But the Commonwealth's involvement with universities changed with the outbreak of World War II.
The full cabinet today directed the war cabinet for the complete mobilisation of all the resources, human and material, for the defence of this Commonwealth. Every human being in this country is now, whether he or she likes it, at the service of the government to work in the defence of Australia.
Under the Curtin government, we have manpower controls, and the universities are subject to those as well. And so they are mandating what must be done, and including what university students should be doing. So during the war, they establish reserved courses that allow those students not to be conscripted into military service, and they impose quotas on those courses, so setting the specific number of students who can attend the Australian universities during the war. And the Curtin government introduced a form of student financial assistance, a financial assistance scheme for these students on the basis that their studies are needed for the war effort.
The universities all volunteered readily to offer their services to the war effort.
Hannah Forsyth is a historian at the Australian Catholic University.
This helped to develop better weapons, it helped to develop better logistics, it helped to facilitate many of the things that the war required. So I think it was a very successful collaboration. I guess universities were a little bit anxious about Commonwealth government interference in them after the war, and it took a little bit of persuading for universities to get on board with an ongoing relationship, but they did.
Well, it was very much part of a nation-building exercise. There was an idea that Australia would become a strong, modern nation, standing at its own feet and all of that kind of stuff.
Raewyn Connell, Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney and a lifelong member of the National Tertiary Education Union.
That it would have an industrial base, because this was also the time when heavy industry was developing in Australia. And also the foundations of an Australian welfare state. So it made sense then, if you were trying to build an industrial economy and a welfare state, expand the capacities of government, it made sense then to have a higher education system and a greater research capacity in Australia. And that was what the Chifley government set out to do when it founded the Australian National University in Canberra. That was intended to provide a kind of research top to the Australian university system. And when the Menzies government came in 1949, it followed on very much from the post-war reconstruction labour planning kind of approach and began putting federal money into what had previously been state universities.
The Commonwealth established the Australian University Commission in 1943 as an independent intermediary between the government and the universities.
The Universities Commission, that was the buffer body that the Commonwealth government put in place in order to try to protect universities from too much government interference. And so this was based on a UK parallel, which placed a buffer between the Commonwealth government and the universities to try to prevent invasions of academic freedom by having too much government control.
The Australian Universities Commission, which was one of a whole raft of public commissions, statutory bodies of one kind or another, which ran many areas of public policy. The ministers didn't actually control the decision-making. I mean, ultimately, the federal government controlled the budget, but there was an intervening level of government created where universities had representatives, unions had representatives, professions had representatives, and you had a more or less continuous debate about the state of universities and what policy should be going on through the 60s, through the 70s.
The number of students is increasing year on year and outgrowing the existing institutions. And so the government has to respond, and it does so by constructing a whole series of new universities within the capital cities and also in regional areas. And it also creates a second tier of higher education known as the College of Advanced Education from 1965, which is aimed at providing more vocationally oriented training. Those colleges of advanced education expand dramatically and prove enormously successful in attracting students from the mid-60s onwards.
It was this stratified system of higher education, with TAFE at the bottom, colleges of advanced education in the middle, and universities at the top, that existed when the Whitlam Labor government came to power in 1972.
It's time to strike a blow for the ideal that education should be free. We will reassert that principle at the commanding heights of education, at the level of the university itself.
Whitlam made three changes when he came to power. He did abolish fees, as you say. He also transferred responsibility for funding universities wholly to the Commonwealth. And he also introduced a tertiary education allowance scheme, TEAS, which is a predecessor of today's OSS study, which is a means-tested living allowance for students. So why did he introduce these changes? Well, I think the general acceptance of increasing the number of trained graduates will provide an economic benefit to the country. But Whitlam took this one step further. He argued that because universities were still predominantly serving middle-class students, we were wasting our human capital. He argued that people were the chief resource of the nation, and it was important for governments not to waste that resource. And he argued that university fees and the cost of attending university was the primary barrier to entry into higher education, and that by removing this, he would unlock university education for a much wider demographic of Australians.
The abolition of fees was meant to democratise institutions. The criticism later on is that it had been a fabulous subsidy to the middle classes, because that's who went to university. And there have been studies that suggested that the socioeconomic composition of universities changed remarkably little despite paying no fees. But I understand that the motivation was principally and genuinely about equity. It was about trying to expand access. By the 1970s, you started to see a growth in demand for institutions. We had, of course, seen a range of new institutions set up through the 60s. So there were a lot more university students by the early 1970s than we'd ever seen before. And demand was also growing. And we started to get a relatively common pattern, not enough places to accommodate all the people who were qualified and who were applying. And that remained true all the way into the 1990s, an almost annual panic about whether there'd be enough university places. And that was very important in keeping universities on the public agenda.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince, and we're tracing the history of university education in Australia. While the Liberal Fraser government retained Whitlam's reforms to higher education, the Hawke Labor government, with its commitment to market reform, had other ideas.
In 1988, higher education in Australia underwent the biggest revolution in its history. Then Education Minister John Dawkins turned the still elitist university system into a mass system, almost doubling the numbers of students to more than 500,000. Universities were merged with colleges of advanced education and forced to run more like large corporations.
Dawkins was one of the supporters of the new turn towards market agendas in the Labor Party, like Keating. He was a believer in the idea of user pays, He did want to expand the university system, and that's often forgotten in commentary now on the result of the Dawkins changes. But they wanted that on the cheap. And you find this in Dawkins' own statements, that this had to be done without largely expanding Commonwealth funding to the university sector. The Treasury wouldn't allow it. At that time, we were in the grip of monetarism, and there was a ceiling on the funding that could be got from the university sector. And that was the central rationale for going back to fees. If you wanted to expand the system, you had to have another form of funding. And the source that was identified was the families of the students. So we introduced fees, and of course, they've ratcheted up ever since.
He also imposed a new structure on the Australian university system, known as the Unified National System. And what this did was removed the category of College of Advanced Education and encouraged all higher education institutions to meet a set of criteria and become universities. And what this did was produce another enormous increase in the number of universities, often made of merged colleges of advanced education, sometimes colleges of advanced education simply converted into universities, and at other times, former colleges of advanced education were merged with universities, so they increased the size of individual institutions as well.
Because at the same time, the government was abolishing those intermediate statutory bodies like the Universities Commission, like the Schools Commission, and bringing back direct ministerial control, it also eliminated the context, eliminated the forum for wider debate about the sector and serious planning. So that one of the immediate results of the Dawkins changes was an incredible free-for-all where universities competed with each other to take over the old colleges of advanced education, and a kind of merger feeding frenzy took place in which planning principles and organizational rationality flew out the window. This is a quite extraordinary process of what should have been, you know, a thoughtful redesign, in fact, became a maelstrom of managerial aggrandizement. And out of that came a fairly unbalanced but definitely expanded university sector.
The institutions we created were big. They were big in 1989 and they are now huge. Australia has universities that are bigger than any others on average in the world. And the reason is, although we created all those new universities through mergers in the late 1980s, early 1990s, we've created hardly any since, which meant all the institutions that we did have grown dramatically. The largest university in Canada is just under 80,000 students. There are two universities in the city of Melbourne that are bigger than that. It's just extraordinary how large they are. When you have very large institutions, you need management systems of a sort that simply didn't exist previously. And a lot of what people complained about at the time and continue to complain about is trying to impose some sort of order and rationality on what were not necessarily rational mergers that then had to be managed. Because suddenly institutions that had one campus and everybody knew each other and they were relatively small have five campuses and they're dozens of kilometres apart and they all have to be managed as part of a system, and you need standardised rules and you need standardised curriculum and you introduce a set of complexities. So Australian universities became much more managerial in that sense, which is always used derisively. But in a sense, the mergers and the policy framework produced a set of tensions that could only be resolved by becoming much more centrally driven than they had traditionally been. And that remains the case in Australia. So we again have much more top-down systems than many countries have, because few other people are attempting to run multi-campus, sometimes multinational institutions in a way that we do here in Australia.
I have to disagree with that. I would say that a larger sector did need different ways of making policy and running institutions, but it didn't have to be corporate managerialism. And this is another side of the Dawkins reform, that they changed the balance of power in universities. and gave a massive and very fast boost to the power of managers. There was no need for universities to grow as big as single corporations as they now are. We could have had a larger number of smaller universities. You don't need mega universities to have a large university system. And if you do have large universities, you don't need them run on the model of corporate profit-making management. You can have them run, for instance, as public institutions. We went down one track, partly because that was in the interests of the top managers, partly because that was the ideology of the fairly conservative governments we've had, and partly because the corporations themselves saw an opportunity in an expanded university system and begun to move in on the university sector. There is now a very significant corporate presence within the university sector through outsourced activities, and through the training of managers, through the provision of a whole range of services, which has changed the ethos of universities, again, gradually, towards competition, profit-making, and hierarchy.
Dash Jazz Saria has spent her adult life employed at Deakin University teaching English. These days, though, she's at home with her pet rainbow lorikeet, Chloe. The crash in international student numbers saw her lose her job after 6.5 years as a casual and on fixed-term contracts. She's had enough and is moving industries.
It's in this kind of atmosphere that we've had those very disturbing changes in patterns of employment, where the teaching in universities has been increasingly casualised to the serious detriment of undergraduate teaching, because that is cheaper and handier for managements that want to be flexible in their allocations of labour.
University teachers are, in general, extremely passionate about what they do, and having expanding student numbers and expanding the types of students that we're seeing in universities has been very exciting for university teachers who have put a lot of work into learning how to teach new kinds of students, into thinking differently about their teaching, and university teachers are altogether very good. It's true that all of them are extremely squeezed. And this is a problem that seems to be worsening, and certainly with casualisation. We've seen in the news the last little while some of the systematic underpayment of casuals, which I was almost surprised to see it in the news at all. We've taken it for granted for so long. And it's not just casuals that are being squeezed to skim read their essays while they're marking because they haven't been given enough time or money to do it. It's also permanent academic staff members who are allocated fewer hours in their total workload than it actually takes to do any of the teaching, and that's done systematically. And this means that everybody is squeezed. When I went to university in the early 90s, they were outraged that tutorial sizes had increased to 12, and now it's not unusual to have 30. And it's just not possible to teach students to the same level of quality if you've got twice as many of them as you used to have. It's a system that can't maintain its level of quality under those conditions.
The business of educating foreign students has become a bonanza for Australia, pulling in $1.7 billion a year.
So we had foreign students for a very long time. It was illegal to charge them, however. So they were foreign students in the sense that they were all on scholarship. Dawkins' package introduced international students not as a sort of throwaway thought, but they considered it to be a very modest change. They didn't see that there would be much demand for international student places, and they didn't see it as central to the reforms. If you were committed to markets as they were and to competition and opportunity, then it made sense, but it wasn't central. The Australian public university sector went on to create the fourth largest export industry in the country in the space of a generation, with annual rates of growth usually in double figures, to the point where Sydney and Melbourne are two of the most successful international education destinations in the world. But if you're a university, it was the only discretionary income you had. The government funding wasn't enough to do anything new. And after a while, governments stopped paying for buildings, for example. If you wanted to put up any new building, you had to fund it yourself. Well, you couldn't fund it from income from domestic students. the only income you could get was from international students. If you wanted to expand research, you had to fund it through international students. So they became central to the system over a way that didn't happen in any other country.
University education was offered to fairly small groups of Asian students as a form of development aid. So they were brought on scholarships, and it was a kind of offering from Australia to poorer countries in the region. So the 1990s then is a really ironic moment where Australia begins to suck money out of poorer countries in Asia through the university system. The fees paid by Australian origin students were capped by the federal government policy, but fees paid by students from overseas were not. So basically then managers realised there was a gold mine here if they could attract a flow of students from other parts of the world, and that basically meant Southeast and East Asia. They could charge what the market would bear, and in the course of time became, I think, about equivalent to the funding from Australian students as an element of the funding of the whole university sector. So it's as if we were getting funded from Asia to expand our and sustain our university system for Australian students, the cross subsidy. We never talk about it in those terms, but that's what it was.
Unambiguously, Australian universities have been highly vulnerable to a global pandemic in a way that not many systems have been. Why do we have so much reliance on international students? And the answer is simple, because the domestic rates of funding are relatively poor compared to comparator institutions in Canada, in the US, in the UK. Australian universities have been much more dependent on raising their own money than equivalent public universities in other countries. So although the rhetoric blames the universities and says it's their fault they're dependent, a different way of asking the same question is, why have successive Australian governments put relatively little money into universities and required them to raise their own money?
We are facing the biggest employment challenge since the Great Depression.
But not all degrees are equal in the eyes of the government. Anyone enrolling in a course considered job relevant, including nursing, agriculture, science and maths, will enjoy a price fall of between 20 and 62%. The cost of studying law and commerce will rise by 28%, with humanities the hardest hit at 113%.
One of the disappointing things about the TN package is that there was no consultation beforehand. He didn't have any process to test his understanding of the issues, because after all, graduates are the most employed people in our country. They have the lowest unemployment. So why is jobs the focus? And in particular, why are we asking people not to do arts and social sciences when they have better employment rates than most of the other subjects we're now going to privilege in funding?
Our government believes that every Australian should have access to a world-class education.
Teacher and student unions watched with concern as the Education Minister failed to offer extra money for what they say is a systemic funding crisis.
We welcome extra places. The problem with it is that it's extra places paid for by existing students.
It's not a pretty picture. We're in for a tough time. And I seriously doubt a university system as stressed as that is going to be highly attractive to overseas students in the future, as the capacities of Asian countries to run their own university systems increases.
Raewyn Connell, Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney. My other guests, Professor Glyn Davis, author of The Australian Idea of a University, Hannah Forsyth, Historian of Education and Associate Professor at the University of New England, and James Waghorn, Senior Research Fellow in the Faculty of Education at the University of Melbourne. The sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.